Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank, focused knowledge, customized solutions, and the resources of an entire bank. Because the best solutions fit around a business's needs. More at key.com/corporate. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Milestone. Noun, an important event, as in a person's career or the advancement of knowledge in a field, a turning point. Today, the Dow flirted with a milestone of its own. What we don't know yet, though, is whether 14,000's a turning point on the way up or on the way down. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, supporting America's public transportation systems, working to help reduce greenhouse gases for a better environment at publictransportation.org. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on this Tuesday. It's the 17th of July. It took a stretch of about 10 months last year for the Dow Jones Industrial Average to make the trip from 11,000 to 12,000. From there, it only took 6 months to reach the 13,000 level back in April. Today, just 57 trading days later, Wall Street's best-known indicator topped 14,000 for the first time. Didn't quite close there, but the blue chips were above it for most of the day. A relatively tame inflation report and some encouraging profit reports added to the momentum today. And while optimism does reign on Wall Street, there are some more questions today about how long the rally might last. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
On a day for popping champagne corks, we figured we'd hear mostly giddy words from Wall Street about where the market's headed. So instead, we went to Cleveland and spoke to a private economist. Ken Maitland heads Clearview Economics, but today even he sounded like a giddy stockbroker.
I think this market is still cheap, and the market being cheap explains why merger and acquisition activity is so strong, because fundamentally this market is cheap. Companies are buying back their stock because the market is cheap and they have confidence in the future.
But many are betting the rally can't last. The Dow and S&P 500 may be breaking records, but there's also a record level of investors taking so-called short positions, essentially betting that prices will fall. Jefferies & Company market strategist Art Hogan was taking a cautious approach in the face of the Dow's latest milestone.
We never go through an extended period of time where we don't have shocks to the system. We're going to get some bumps in the road. It's never a straight line up. There's always some volatility, and I think we should expect that in the future.
Barring the unexpected, though, economist Ken Maitland is ever the optimist. He points to today's tame inflation news, which makes the Fed less likely to raise interest rates right away. He even sees a silver lining in those costs that did go up. He thinks rising prices for home appliances, furniture, and lumber could signal a stabilizing housing market. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Just to close the loop here on that inflation report that Bob was talking about, the producer price index, which is wholesale inflation, dropped 0.2% last month. When you get a second, go to your favorite website, then try to find something using the search function. Chances are, unless it's a pretty well-engineered site, your search isn't going to work out so well, which can be bad for business. So today, the company synonymous with search stepped in. From the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio, Janet Babin reports.
Lots of mid-sized businesses already use a free version of Google Search on their sites. Take Seth Godin. He founded Squidoo.com. At the bottom of his marketing blog, visitors can search just his site or the entire web through Google. But both options take users away from Godin's site, back to Google's pages, and advertising, where customers might find something they like better. But Godin's okay with that.
My philosophy has always been the more you're connected, the better you do. But there are plenty of businesses that want to invest the money to make their site an island on the web.
That's sort of what Google's new search service offers. It lets companies with hard-to-navigate sites employ Google's user-friendly search technology. Companies can better control visitor searches so customers can find what they need without leaving their web page. The new product also lets businesses limit the paid ads that show up on searches or even get rid of Google's brand on searches.
This idea of it's my storefront, I control it, is worth a lot.
Prices for the new service start at just $100 a year. Scott Kessler with Standard & Poor's says that's chump change for Google, but he says the new service will eventually pay off.
Years and years down the road, this initiative could actually result in some material revenues as a result of customers essentially liking what Google offers and buying more, or just the companies themselves and their websites getting bigger.
Kessler says this is a great opportunity for Google to get a foothold in countless small to mid-sized businesses. Plus, the new options probably won't cost Google very much to pull off. The company will use the same technology it already employs for other searches. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
14,000 came today, and then it went. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It appears to be all over but the shouting for Wall Street Journal parent company Dow Jones and Rupert Murdoch. Published reports today in the Journal, mind you, say that Murdoch and Dow CEO Richard Zannino have come to a tentative understanding. Murdoch gets the Journal, Barron's, Dow Jones Newswires, and a bunch of other properties. Dow Jones shareholders get $5 billion of Murdoch's dollars. Dow's board is set to vote on the matter this evening. What the Bancroft family, which controls about 64% of Dow's voting stock, thinks might not be known until next week sometime. So we called Forbes magazine's managing editor Dennis Neal to talk about Mr. Murdoch's investment. Mr. Neal, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
So Rupert Murdoch's paying a 65% premium on the share price from May the 1st when news of this deal broke. So obviously, no question, it's a good deal for Dow Jones shareholders. Question is, though, is it a good deal for Rupert Murdoch?
Well, this will be a great deal for Rupert Murdoch in many ways. It instantly takes a guy who is dismissed as this Australian-born U.S. citizen, a tabloid press lord, and gives him credibility by owning one of the best journalistic brands in the entire world. It'll be a good deal for that reason. Also, with this new financial news cable channel that Rupert Murdoch's News Corp is starting up, the Wall Street Journal offers an instant flow of content and even on-air talent if he can manage to buy out the contract that CNBC has with the Wall Street Journal.
That's all well and good, but the last time we checked, newspapers were a struggling business model in this country. How's he going to use all the leverage that you say he's buying if the paper itself is struggling?
Well, the great thing for this deal is that it gives the Wall Street Journal a whole extra outlet to serve with its content, and that is, of course, cable television. And the Journal is not a dying dinosaur. The Journal is a collection of 100 of some of the most trusted bloggers and experts in the world, and they can write for any platform. And the more platforms you can spread that content and those costs over, the better it is for the company.
We ought to point out here probably that you were at the Journal for about 16, 17 years.
I was there for 16 years. I grew up at the Wall Street Journal, and I love that newspaper, but I must tell you, the editors there are being really precious and really spoiled in their approach to this Rupert takeover. And that is one problem with the Wall Street Journal and why it is weak today, is it is regarding itself as special when really a newspaper is nothing more than a business. And you better make that business work if you hope to stand on your own.
Okay, but hold on a second. What's your take on what the reporters at the Journal are feeling today? Would you guess that maybe they're looking for other opportunities?
I'm sure the reporters at the Journal are dressed in black. They're hanging crepe. They're lamenting a horrible, terrible thing to happen to the newspaper. I'm sure that some of them will start looking for jobs. And you know what? They're going to have to, because I predict big cutbacks at the Journal. I think that newsroom has 500 employees. I'll bet you they need only 400.
Wow. You think Rupert Murdoch's going to do that?
I think Rupert Murdoch will do that. He'll wait a certain period to honor the Bancroft family, but then he will come in and he will cut. They have a new Saturday edition that's largely a failure. They ought to kill the Saturday edition. They have an entire Europe staff for a newspaper that in 25 years, the European edition, has almost never turned a profit. You ought to kill the European edition. Right there, those two big moves would save tons of money, but they would result in the layoff of dozens and dozens of people.
Last question before I let you go, Mr. Neal. Any doubt in your mind that the Dow board's going to approve this and that the Bancroft family will eventually approve it?
The surprise here is that they're acting like there is any tension at all as to whether the Bancroft family will approve. The Bancroft family has enough votes to turn down that offer out of hand, and yet they sat down and talked with a guy they do not like, and that is the surest signal that the Bancroft family dare not turn down this offer. They have basically poorly served other Dow Jones shareholders for the better part of 25 years. They dare not turn it down.
Dennis Neal is the managing editor of Forbes magazine. Mr. Neal, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Take almost any kid under the age of 10 or so to the grocery store, and they'll amaze you with their knowledge of consumer brands. They know which cereal is sugariest and which snack has more chocolate. The knowledge, though, didn't come easy. It took hours sitting in front of a television set watching ads paid for by food and beverage makers. The Federal Trade Commission meets tomorrow to talk about those ads and possibly about regulating how food companies sell their products. That's not something the industry wants to have happen, so they're expected to reveal their own rules tomorrow as well. A lawsuit's already forced Kellogg to back off pitching its sugared cereals during children's programs, and it's thrown into question what will happen to the $1 billion or more spent marketing snacks to kids. From WBUR in Boston, Monica Brady-Myrov has more.
The Carlson household in Wakefield, Massachusetts, runs a healthy kitchen.
You're hungry? Do you want an apple? Okay.
Sherry Carlson gives her 5-year-old daughter, Paige, an organic apple for a snack. She only buys organic food for her husband and 3 children. Sherry is also one of the plaintiffs whose lawsuit resulted in Kellogg's agreeing to adopt nutrition standards for the foods it markets to children. But none of that stops her daughter from demanding junk food when they're shopping.
She saw a product that she had never had. I can't say for sure. It was either Dora or Dragon Tails, something, some kind of fruit roll-up thing. I was like, no, I'm not getting that because I really dislike buying the junk. And she had a complete meltdown. So it was interesting because she had never had the product, but she just saw the character and wanted it.
The tantrum made Sherry think. What was influencing her daughter's choices? It didn't take long to figure out.
I just want to warn you, Mr. Krabs, we're always fashionably late.
SpongeBob is one of Paige's favorite shows. Sherry says her children watch a lot of TV, and so they see a lot of commercials.
What is that one, Paige?
Fruit gummies.
Fruit gushers. No, is there anything nutritional about fruit gushers? Not really.
Sugar, artificial colors, sugar, artificial colors, sugar.
Children see about 31 ads on TV an hour, and until the age of 8, they usually don't know ads are trying to sell them something. The intent to sue was filed by the Center for Science in the Public Interest and the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood. After a year of negotiations, Kellogg's agreed last month to voluntarily stop marketing foods to kids under 12 that don't meet certain nutrition guidelines for sugar, fat, sodium, and calories. About 30% of Kellogg's cereals will be pulled from ads on children's TV. It also agreed to stop using characters on products, such as putting Shrek on a box of Eggos. Susan Lin, co-founder of the campaign, says public outrage has reached a tipping point.
There has been a really concerted grassroots effort to raise public awareness about the kinds of foods that are being marketed to kids, the kinds of techniques that the marketers are using.
And the government is also turning up the heat. After Kellogg's announcement, one congressman demanded to know what the other top 5 food and beverage companies would do. Some replied they already have limits in place. McDonald's, Pepsi, and General Mills said they will unveil new initiatives at the Federal Trade Commission meeting. The food industry is motivated to make changes themselves because members of Congress say they might make regulations if they don't. Kathleen Siders is a professor of marketing at Boston College.
The food companies have to take steps in terms of marketing to children because it's just become too front and center as an issue. And also, there's a fair amount of evidence that it has a negative effect, and we just can't afford that anymore because obesity is too big of a health problem.
Child advocate Susan Lin says she wishes the government would step in and do more.
One of the things about self-regulation is that a company can make a policy, but they can change it at any time. There's nobody holding them accountable for that. And if these policies that they're implementing aren't profitable, you can bet your life that they're going to be changing them.
The impact of the voluntary guidelines might just be to move the ads. A new FTC study found that more than half of the ads kids watch aren't during what's considered children's programming. So Kellogg's could still pitch Pop-Tarts just so it airs during prime time. In Boston, I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov for Marketplace.
I learned everything I needed to know about the capitalist system from commercials for sugar cereals.
Commentator Joel Stein.
I got to choose one sugary cereal every year for our vacation week on the Jersey Shore, and I spent the previous 11 and three-quarter months parsing the marketing campaigns. Honeycomb's big, yeah, yeah, yeah. It's not small, no, no, no. Were it the most complicated lyrics that anyone's ever come up with? But I could tell I was being peddled value, something I wasn't looking for in a once-a-year purchase. I liked the anti-authoritarian feel of the Trix Rabbit, but the fact that he was told in a weirdly apartheid-like way that he couldn't have any because Trix are for kids completely clashed with my aspirational aims towards adulthood. Lucky Charms laid claims to the magic of making things delicious, but even back then I could see that there was some cheap sleight of hand that repackaged dehydrated hot chocolate marshmallows in different shapes and colors. Kellogg's Fruit Loops baffle me to this day. It seems like an ad for kids created by a wine snob. You see, guys, this toucan with an enormous nose, kind of a super taster bird, is going to fly around pointing out notes of strawberry, lemon, and dark cherries. Kids will love it. You see, an entire industry filled with corporations with serious-sounding names like Post and General Mills was desperate to win me over. And I took that responsibility of choosing very seriously. Sure, my base desires screamed Cookie Crisps. The genius of an entire bowl of milk-dunk cookies that I was allowed to eat for breakfast. But that's not who I wanted to be. I wanted to be mature, smart, subtle, to simply touch my tummy with a taste of nuts and honey. I got my parents to buy me Honey Nut Cheerios. Now kids won't have that kind of capitalist training. And I fear for our nation's future.
Joel Stein is a columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Your thoughts on your favorite sugary cereal or anything else? Send them to us through our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, the shaky foundations of China's boom.
You buy it from Vietnam, India, and all that, it's the same. The people who are doing this manufacturing seize an opportunity to become rich very quickly.
But first, let's do the numbers. Closed but no cigar on Wall Street. Today, the blue chips dipped before the market closed. The Dow Industrials finished up 20 points. That's a tenth of 1%. Closed at a new record high, though, of 13,971. The NASDAQ climbed 14 points, half a percent, to finish the day at 2712. The S&P 500 didn't do much of anything, really. Ended the day pretty much where it started, at 1549. News Corp was looking hot off the presses. We talked about the parent of Fox News making a tentative deal to buy Dow Jones. Investors weren't waiting to read all about it, though. Get it? Read all about it. News Corp shares scanned up 2.6%. Somehow, all of that love didn't spread to Dow Jones. The publisher of the Wall Street Journal sagged more than 0.8%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 5.06%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. These reports come directly from the experiences of the members themselves. Angie'sList.com. And by American Public Media's weekly program, Speaking of Faith. Starting July 19th, Krista Tippett explores the ethics of eating with author Barbara Kingsolver, speakingoffaith.org. a report on Marketplace that you just have to share with your friends, family, or coworkers? Help is just a click away. Our website has each day's complete newscast, individual stories, and transcripts, so you can listen again, print them out, or email them to everyone you know. It's all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Wednesday. The Labor Department releases the Consumer Price Index for June. The Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee discusses the impact of unsafe Chinese imports on consumers. And every dog has his day. Tomorrow is National Hot Dog Day. According to the National Hot Dog and Sausage Council, Americans typically consume 7 billion Frankfurters during the dog's high season between Memorial and Labor Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. It's not cheap to hang on to good employees no matter where you work, but the federal government faces special circumstances. Some employees could make buckets more money doing similar work in the private sector. In the massive bureaucracy of the federal government, the Food and Drug Administration is home to some of the biggest employee retention bonuses, the same agency that can only afford to inspect about 1% of the nation's food imports, a fact that led to some grilling at a congressional hearing today. From Washington, Jeremy Hobson reports.
In 2005, the FDA accounted for nearly 40% of the more than $21 million the federal government paid in bonuses. The only other agency in the same league is the Department of Defense. So why does the FDA need such big bonuses? Here's the answer from spokesman Rob Ely.
We have a large number of physicians, pharmacists, scientists, biostatisticians, PhDs, and other such experts who are in high demand in the private sector.
The bonuses at the FDA tripled between 2002 and 2006, but it appeared to cost the agency more to hold on to drug experts than food safety workers. Of the $9.5 million in FDA bonuses last year, those workers only got about $265,000. Congressman Bart Stupak of Michigan is a Democrat who chaired today's hearing.
Congress did not intend $10 million for a food safety program to then be used and turn around to be used for $9.5 million in bonuses for drug approval.
Stupak says the bonus bonanza is part of a larger issue of ineptitude on the part of the FDA. The agency's ability to keep food safe has come under scrutiny in recent months following a flurry of problems. Chris Waldrop is director of the Food Policy Institute at Consumer Federation of America.
Having a story like this come out doesn't look good on FDA. It's an agency that's broken, that doesn't have the money it needs to be able to do its job, and the agency is having to just put out fires.
Waldrop adds that the FDA still needs more money, and Congress should give it to them. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Food safety inspectors have had their hands full the past couple of months. I don't think I need to say any more than Chinese imports, and you'll know exactly what I mean. But that's really only one way to look at it. The other might best be summed up in Latin, caveat emptor, buyer beware. But there's a Chinese version of that, too, as our Shanghai correspondent Scott Tong found out not long after he set up shop last January.
When we first moved into our office, it sounded like this.
Eventually, we built a studio that sounds like this, but not without delays and aggravation and quality problems along the way. It started with Mr. Han, the contractor. He came recommended to us, we liked his work, and so we hammered out a deal over coffee. We'd pay him $5,000 to outfit our sound booth in our office. Sounded good. Mr. Han's men started working, so we gave them some space. My colleague Eric Johnson headed up the project. He's an audio engineer.
I've always been kind of a hands-off kind of guy and trusting.
Hands-off and trusting. Big mistake. We noticed the fresh paint looked kind of thin, and when we saw the can, we realized they substituted a cheaper grade of paint, so we made them start over. James Rice has worked in China for 20 years. He's with Tyson Foods.
The cheaper paint in China is not going to meet the kind of quality regulations you would expect in the U.S., so it's going to have lead or other poisonous fumes. It's typical for a Chinese to renovate their home and air it out for a month before they move in to let all those fumes go out.
Substituting dangerous ingredients is at the center of China's product safety scandal, whether it's toy trains or pet food or toothpaste. Rice says when you deal with suppliers here, you have to do the Ronald Reagan thing, trust but verify. When he hired contractors to renovate his house,
I bought all the materials and I was on site every day to validate what they were doing.
As for our construction, we got into a spat with a contractor over shoe molding. You know, that strip of wood where the wall meets the floor? We'd always assumed it was included in the deal. Wrong. Mr. Han noted it wasn't specifically stipulated in the contract, so we had to pay more to get what we wanted.
I was furious.
Again, my colleague Eric Johnson.
I thought it was one of the most inane conversations I've had in my life. You know, it's like, you wanted a car with tires on it? Why would you have tires on a car? It's just insane.
The lesson? You can't assume things work here the way they work back home. Malaysian businessman K.Y. Lai has been sourcing from China for decades. He says if you don't pay attention to the tiny details, disaster can strike. Once he bought a shipment of nails.
And the shipments of those nails, they had no head. Either it's bad quality control or nobody cares. We can't sell it.
Eventually, Mr. Han's men finished the job. Or so we thought. Soon after, we ran into ventilation problems and paint peeling, again with the paint. So we called the contractor and expected a little customer service. Wrong expectation. Here's my colleague Linda Lin yelling at the contractor's foreman.
Hey, Xiaohu. Ah? 怎么还没有过来给我们修墙?
And here's the foreman's response. Foreigners complain a lot about customer service in China. It's maddening. But Tyson Foods' James Rice explains that many local suppliers have never actually learned the concept.
If you've never received good customer service, it's really hard for you to imagine working a job where you would give good customer service.
That would be the charitable explanation. A more sinister one comes from Mr. Han, our contractor.
Foreign customers don't know how to operate now. Their expectations are low and they pay more, so we like doing business with foreigners.
Haha, it's funny. Now, it's tempting to blast China as the one place in the world with dodgy quality and business partners who cut corners. But Asian business veteran K.Y. Lai says, not so.
You buy it from Vietnam, India, and all that, it's the same. The people who are doing this manufacturing seize an opportunity to become rich very quickly.
I.e. buyer beware. Problem is, folks like us don't figure that out until we get burned. Swindled in Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a mix of large U.S. companies can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, getting back to where we started with a definition, this time of profit. No need to look that one up in the dictionary. Turns out it is the dictionary. Answers.com announced today it's paying $100 million cash for some word-worthy domain names. They include dictionary.com, thesaurus.com, and reference.com. For its money, Answers gets a bump in traffic on the order of 22.5 million unique visitors to those websites every month. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 20 points, a tenth of 1% to 13,971. The NASDAQ gained 14 points, half a percent. The S&P 500 stayed basically flat, 1549 the close there. Thanks to Miguel Macias and Renita Jablonski on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Wendy Sykes. Next time on this program, a veteran company gets hip to hemp leaves.
I couldn't understand why we were trying to promote Canada by putting this maple leaf on the front of a sweater. And they looked at me and said, "Are you sure you understand what that is?"
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.